Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up in 2002 with a grant from the Scarman Trust. We're on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. That's bcfmradio.com. This week we're off to Hereford and a tiny shop opposite the Town Hall run by Dilwyn Jones in St Owen Street. It's called Lock, Stock and Barrel. Quite a unique little place. And Professor Alexander Azargan. He gives another perspective on the Kurdistan referendum from his university home in California. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk and we're based at the People's Republic of Stokes Croft on Jamaica Street. I'll give you our contact details at the end of the show.
In my own world, I talk to you like this. I tell you really, in the modern world, how it is.
I'm Dilwyn Jones. I'm from an agricultural background originally. Orkup Garway, which is towards Abergib anyway. Come from a very, very traditional farming background. Left home at 15 and worked in this trade since.
Tell us about your shop here, because you're right smack bang in the middle of Hereford, right opposite the Town Hall, but it's not your average shop, is it?
It's a bit of a dinosaur, really, in a modern world, but it works. I've made it work.
It's a hardware shop. You've got a bit of everything here, and a lot of it seems to be new, but a lot of it is second-hand, and you don't normally see that in a hardware shop with so much second-hand stuff. I mean, for example, these pails here, they could be second-hand. Some of the bill hooks, things like that, are second-hand. A lot of these, whatever they are, pulleys, runners and things, shackles maybe, that seems to be second-hand. Yeah. I'd say you probably got more second-hand than you have brand-new. Is that true?
Not really, no. I think what it amounts to is the tools, from me being a kid, has always been a big interest. And we got a massive blacksmithing college where they love the old hammers. I used to use a hacker and was a show edger at 12. And so I got a bit of a museum of them. So the people using those traditionally today have mainly died. But people collect them.
Is there a blacksmithing college? That's quite an interesting institution around here.
It is. Biggest in Europe. Hereford College is the biggest in Europe. They come from Scandinavia, all over the place. And the old hammers and that are of a higher quality. And basically they use them to make templates and moulds. So believe it or not, as boring as they look at the bottom of the floor there, there are young end users on the hammers, whereas some of the stuff, the people using them have died, which means they're obsolete.
Now, looking up at the ceiling, you've got all sorts here. You've got metal pails, you've got old, looks like copper kettles, copper saucepans, and round to the left-hand side, lots of lamps. Now, a lot of those, they're not electric. Are they oil or hurricane lamps?
No. I mean, 90% of the people using paraffin heaters commercially, that's gone. But there's an interest because they've been in the family, people want glasses, they want wicks for them, and there is a rural area around here where they won't set the world on fire turnover-wise, but this is the place to come. So, yeah, we do okay with the bits.
Most of your customers, are they commercial or just walking off the street?
I suppose because I've established it as a headache shop with all the bits that nobody else has got. I think it's a bit like a sweet shop. I think people come in here because they know they'll always get the item they want, and B, there's also the holiday trip side of it where they just like looking around. You'll be amazed how many people return, and it's not just old, it's young as well. And a lot of them will make a destiny. They've got to buy something here on either an anniversary or a set interval when they come down. If you drop this shop in certain parts of the country, the answer is it would never get off the ground. But Hereford is still a rural, listed buildings. It's changing, yes, the younger people. But all the same, if somebody's got a house and they're doing cosmetic bits, they'd rather buy it off the shelf and see what it is than the internet. So small items, there is still a market if you can do other things to make it work.
Wilkinson's, you know, you surely can't compete with them.
Well, you're wrong there. Basically, Wilkinson is the Tesco of the world, the same as B&Q. They put the same shop in London's Hereford. If I had this shop outside B&Q, believe it or not, it would be far better with the locksmithing, the key cutting, than your. I work long hours, I help anybody out and I'm interested, but if somebody upsets me, I can be awkward, but I can be helpful. So what I'm saying, I've had 47 years in retail, and I set this up if I said to you, ask me about a car or anything like that, I'm as dull as a bat. Really. But because I spent 47 years in this and I'm off the most humble, primitive background, left home at 15 and rebuilt Rayburns and learned this tradition because I used it below Sackers, that commercially in this country has finished years ago. If we didn't have the Armangry and locks, the shop would have gone bust before I opened the doors 32 years ago. So what I'm trying to get at is, to give you an insight into it if you're interested, I used to work for Philip Morris's, which was trading from 1845 right up to 1984, and this would have been all the way through the country. The DIYs did not affect the hardware shop as such one bit. When Tesco's opened, they killed the corner shop dead overnight. But what happened was, and this is, I knew this when I set this up 32 years ago, and that is why the shop is still here. This shop, if I didn't own it, didn't run it myself, and we didn't have the expertise on the listed building, we would be gone before I opened it up. No matter how knowledgeable, it wouldn't work. So what it amounts to, for 150 years, Philip Morris is, and everywhere up and down the country, I've got a museum on it, had an agricultural armourer. Now, assuming I'm telling you the truth, if you had a video here every day, you'll see why I can be helpful and rude. Not because I want to be rude.
But you're your own boss. You
that isn't a... If I'm in here every day, and I've never had a holiday, and I'm up at 5 o'clock, and if you come in to me, and you're a pole or a check, you say, excuse me, I've got a problem with this, I'd like a little patch on my bucket. No problem. You're a customer. 50 pence, put it on. Real grateful. If somebody comes in front of you, and they haven't lived through the years... and this is where this is outdated. This is where the personality, it's no good me arguing with you about two screws and you don't want 10. I'll never come in here again, mate. I'm your customer. No, but that is what you get. That is the rudeness. Now, what I'm saying to you is, Philip Morris is for 150 years. Philip Morris is with an agricultural armonger established from 1845 right to 1984. They had 36 staff selling best armongers in the country. Galvanised tubes, 6 foot Stilsons, billocks, rivets, Ackers. Now, assuming I'm telling you the truth, I left home off a primitive farm using billocks and Ackers. I was started there at 15. And we were the best customer in the country selling hop hooks round. The best. Right hand and left hand. I used to order 144 right hand and 36 in my time.
Is that like a billock, a hop hook?
Yeah, a hop hook is like a grass hook. But you'll be interested on this if you... So anyway, what happened was, assuming I'm telling you the truth, when the two Ronnies went into the hardware shop, he was a very clever bloke. Because, if I'm telling you the truth, he had a counter. So what happened was, all the council local authorities, I'll have 10 record planes, number 4, please, book them out to Kingston School. Big money. Kids' school. Kinley School. I want a record number 4 plane, please, made him a carpenter. So for 150 years, their trade bookings and apprenticeships... bought premium tools, e.g. I was on £5 a week in 1970, a spade was £18, and we sold loads. 4 times my wages. Pots and pans, aluminium covered in dust about the creosote. Old farmer's wife cooked the grub, it was functional, no frills. 95% of the stuff was trade. The public never paid. That's why he did the act about the washers and tools. That was true. Can you imagine... husband sending the wife in saying, I want some bolts, my husband's pulling the fence together. So the first time you'll say it, right, what thickness? Well, show me some. So you, the attitude of going down the back was negative, because whatever you brought up, she'd go, oh, there's different lengths and thicknesses there. Do you know what I mean? So when he picked hold of that, he was a very clever bloke. He used to go into a hardware shop, because I've studied all this in Bradford and Avon, and he used to watch, and he used to take notes, and he used to ask if he did, and they said yes. The reason why this is, you're... I spent all my life here, I'm not married, and underneath, I've got to be a bit nuts. But in theory, as a businessman, this is not the way to run a shop. You think I'm joking, don't you? But anyway, going away on it quickly, Philip Morris's now is across the way. Well, for 150 years, end of the year, 95% of the stuff sold, so they could coot around with the public with the two washers or argue about it. It didn't matter, because the bookings was always there. Maggie Thatcher finished the apprenticeships in 1984, bigger than the internet or anything else has happened in this country. All the bookings stopped. All the lands that were leaving school, roofing, plumbing, there was imported stuff before, but all this identity of branded stuff literally changed within 4 or 5 months. They were losing. They were flat out with the public coming in, arguing about two screws. I'll never use them. Can you cut this off? Oh, can I have that part off that lock? I want to buy it all. All that knowledge, flat out, and the branded stuff was not selling. They were going to close the shop, and they owe 150 euros a trade in mind. In the middle, all right, they're from the butter market. You'll see them now, but this is what saved them. They were very, very concerned, and they were going to close the shop. Well, you would when you're 150 euros making big money. Best armings in the country. All of a sudden, the booking stop, and you're in the High Street, don't forget. And all of a sudden, the public are swarming in there. Can you have my husband have this? Can you cut it off? Oh, I do want 10 of them. So all this knowledge, and the branded kit was not selling. So what happened was, they called in consultants. And they were said, well, I've said to you today, that was 32 years ago. They said, look, I've been watching him. He's been going out the back, getting a Whitworth bolt. One of the customers says, oh, you don't want 10 of those. He spent 20 minutes on that and he's put 10 pence in the till. So the thing was, it was outdated then. So they said, what you need to do is the coloured augers of Rayburn started to come out. And don't forget, the cookware was the worst line in the shop. The consultants were watching this for 3 months. And they said to him, look, there is no future in all the knowledge you're giving with those bolts and those screws. You aren't contributing to selling the tools and the bulk that pays the wages. Get what you need to do is you either close the shop, you get rid of all that branded tools and sell them off at cost in the next couple of weeks, put an imported range of tools in the corner, don't make the nuts, bolts and screws and all this labour intensive, put them in limited bags and make people make up their own mind. Not for them to queue up, waiting, oh, I've been waiting 10 minutes and fretting about two washers, because it said you're giving too much advice, but you're generating nothing. So it wasn't rocket science. They said, what you need to do is, the coloured Rayburns are coming out, get the cookware, that aluminium, get rid of it, start to put £100 pots coloured, the match lagers, and don't get involved with the public too much. No, seriously, that was 32 years ago. So they turn around, and they were reluctant to do this. Well, think about it. If you come in, you're now off the High Street today, and you didn't know me, and you were like they do, but they've got a tie and a shirt, and they're talking to you. I don't suppose you know, mate, I might as well ask. I'm looking for a screw about that length, right? I had a lot of conversation, and you're listening to it, and you've heard it all before, so you go out the back, and you get to, right, so there you are, there's 60 people. Ah, but I'm the customer, mate, you know, I don't need that, you know, I only want one. So after all that knowledge, you're getting a war. Now, whether the shopkeeper's right or wrong, there's a confrontation then of interest, and the customer say, well, you know, I am the customer. And I shall say, well, you know, I don't begrudge you that. If you buy something else, sir, I'll give you that. So it won't come in your again. So you've really upset a customer, and he's going to say, funny stood in there. He wouldn't sell me one screw. I won't go in there again. I walk away and say, it's outdated, totally outdated. But I do all this because the building trade and the builders, when they set that up, they put £100 pots in there, put females in there. If somebody's playing with a phone and a female goes in, she doesn't need any brains. She likes buying that. She puts it down here. I'll be back next week. Good shop, that. Nobody's interrupt at all. Big money. The guy who's dealing head on about tuppence is having a verbal war, which is no good in a modern high street. So what I'm saying is, if that was 32 years ago, I set this up 6 months later, lived in a caravan and bought this, sold my house. I own the shop, and I knew there was no future as an ironmonger then. But don't forget, I'm a locksmith. I know the area, Rayburns, and what have you. So then, when I opened this, these tools have always been an interest to me. You know, I told you a spade was £18. I was on £5 a week. Do you know how much a spade's retailing now, 47 years on, 20% VAT? A fiver. No, I'm in the back for the older person, only because of my background. I source these for little old ladies. A hardwood anvil in the modern world I stopped making just now is £10.28. I'm in the back for an hour and a half's work, charging a fiver plus VAT, £6. I've overpriced myself and made no money. Minimum wage for you would be £8 an hour. I'd have to charge you at 12 quid, the handle, and if I was renting the shop, would anybody bring it in? No. So the answer is, it's finished. So I do all this side of it as an interest, but the woman in front of you has just spent 33 quid on black fittings for a listed building. Easy. She come in, I told it all about, and then chuck the screws in. But what I'm saying to you is, now 32 years have moved on, there isn't a shop like this in the centre of town, so do you know what they're doing? Think about it. I've always been cheap on the keys half the price, and I've always captured the market of the builders. Will have a count with Jewsons. They pull out your, have a lock with 40 keys. Our mortgage keys are a fiver, Yale's a three. Good business. Think about it. Timpsons, all the time. 800 depots, younger generation. Double the money, at 9 or 10 quid on those. A fiver on a Yale. One in the market, one there. Now, what's happened is the council now has strangled the town. No parking areas. All the places outside. Builder thinks, I'm not going to park it tight now. He gets a lock with his door at Jewson, gives it the teacher, she claims the money back, goes straight in there and cutting less keys than ever. All the customers, apart from the ones that want proper stuff like the Harmongry now, they want a Brumhead, young, under 30. We got all the yard brubs under the sun. That air is dying. They go into Tesco's, pick a plastic Addis, one totally wrong thing make you do. I've got the full range. Older people are dying. Knackered. 26 butchers in this town. 3 left now. They aren't relying on the people coming to the door. Not because they're no good. They're doing pig roast barbecues because the high street is knackered and the meat's good and the young people know it.
But it's just all supermarkets.
No, but it isn't the supermarkets doing it.
That's what's killed the butchers, no, surely.
No, not really. No, I disagree. I'm off a farm myself. If you want to see a town badly managed, look at this lot. No, this is terribly badly managed. I mean, why am I talking to you like this in depth? And I've spent 47 years and I've seen, and I'm saying to you, Hereford, lowest wages in the country. All right? I could tell you all about Somerset and all, even though I spend a lot of time, I do a lot of reading, I went to the Western Daily Press, and I could tell you economics as well. I've checked the wages over there. You've got 10 people on over there in that offices. The council, the general high nogs the council. And to do with the planning in different areas all around the council, you've got about 9 of them on in excess of 80 to 150,000 a year in the lowest amount. And if you look at the way they've managed this town, absolutely abysmal. Do you know why I say that? Lowest wages in the country. If I've worked in town and I've seen the demise of it, and it's not the demise, you've got Boomers, Heineken, Sun Valley, Wiggins, very level plateau, no big manufacturing industry. You also got a lot of poles and checks that are working here, which means they're working on land. So all the barrel of the wages from Ross, Hereford, all that is a very level playing field. This, I owned this, don't forget, 32 years ago. You couldn't cut for the butter market any day of the week, okay? Council owned it was then. They've just sold it recently. All right, the butter market, indoor butter market. Haven't put a lick in a paint, spend no money. Built all these out-of-town areas. When I opened this 32 years ago, the coaches used to pull all out, you're nowhere for them to go. One place having coffee on a Sunday, and I used to say to the councillors when they were on about building this development, which is about to collapse, which is at a sell by date, used to come in here and they were in, and the three councillors were in it on the meetings only. Very small-minded, they knackered it 30-odd years ago partly. So I said, why are you building that for multiples in there? Cardiff, Cheltenham have got it. Hereford's on a limb. It ain't going to work. Oh, it will. We're going to get CNA and pay him. I said, won't. Why don't you? I said, get a subsidised cafeteria, cider museum, Hereford cattle, cater for what you've got, low wages, tourist, and a coach park, subsidised with a roof on. Now we'll get CNA, we'll get all the big names in there, we'll really do well. What did they do? Don't forget, no area for the coaches to park. No coffee shop in open on a Sunday. So what happens? They build it with the multinationals, pay CNA in there, 18 months, CNA are still losing money, they pull out. They've progressively built outside town. They've stuck coffee shops here everywhere in the mess. They've got no facility for the coaches. So they're going to Worcester, they're going to Monmouth, they're going to Aber, they're going to Ledbury. They're bypassing it because there's no air. So you've got coffee wagons everywhere. All the traditional shops of any size have gone out of business. They've charged arm and leg for parking. They've got traffic wardens hounding them on a Sunday. Yeah, but the end result is the butter market's been sold because they're always not working because they've built all these places outside. Nobody's going to get a pound of bananas. They've got a girl from Birmingham setting up stall here 3 times a week. A hell of us taking the money back there. Well, everything that they've done, if you looked at the farmer's market here, I went yesterday afternoon after working in the morning, down Abergavenny, because I used to live in between there. They had a food festival. And if you saw it, there were 600 to 700 cars on the playing fields and the streets full of it. You want to see the shambles here? There's nothing on the bank holidays. Nothing on the river. That restaurant there has changed hands 5 times in the last 3 years. So the reason this works is, in an ordinary town, this would not have got off the ground. And anywhere up and down the country, they've all gone like this. But I know that. But I knew that when I started it. But think about it. Even though I run it old side, I guarantee you now, I could tell you, I've steered this completely different anywhere else. And the reason why this works is, our stock is about 99.5 availability. You won't catch us out. Now, it seems incredible seeing it all here. I spend hours, and it's ordered well in advance, and it goes elsewhere, if I bet, and the locks and the keys, and they always know we've got it. So I've built up the image, because I haven't done a lifestyle outside. I'm not married, and I spend all my time here. But in real terms of a business employing young lads, muddling around with all advice and knowledge, it's a non-goer. Really. It's been for years. So, yeah, I am interested in it. But the town itself, to be honest with you, is finished. And if you told me where you come from, I could tell you probably the ironmongers that you used to have there as well.
Well, Stroud.
Yeah, well, you used to have Butts, the builder's merchants, which got taken over now. Yeah. Butts and Son, they were quite a good one. You also got... See, Stroud, you're in a good area there. Towards the Cotswolds, you see, and getting around there, there is room for an agricultural ironmonger, not a DIY. This would be no good year selling power tools and paint and being the cheapest in town. You'd be knackered. There's another one that was the other side of Stroud that has gone recently. It's a bit further on. It's Brutonmore.
Well, I mean, I also work in Bristol quite a bit as well.
You used to have Patterson's there.
Yeah.
You had Nyes.
I don't remember
that. You had Nyes. Yeah, no. Patterson's was the big one. Bristol down deep. There again, Bristol should honour a good agriculture. But Philip Morris is my old place. If you go in there now, they got... It's like Harrods. It's a beautiful store. You're quickly, Tony. If this one's interest you, you're a warlock. Do you know what that is?
Mine.
Do you know what that is?
That is... No.
Oh, you disappointed me. Do you know what that is?
No. What are they for?
Hang on. I don't...
It's for beating something, isn't it? What are they for, these? Panel beating, I'm guessing. No.
They're lead tools for beating lead on listed buildings.
Oh, really?
They're actually Ligma, which is a really hard wood, which means that no matter how much you smash it, it'll never splinter. It's knotted. They used to use it on the axles of carts.
Good God.
Yeah, amazing. There are. Look. This works, because I make it work. But in the real world of overheads and what have you, you'd never get a shop like that.
You wouldn't
work.
Be able to do it unless you'd bought it yourself,
no.
Would
do you? Do you know what? 95% of the turnover that keeps the shop open is ironmonger and locks. Even though we're busy on this, it is in the real
terms... You've got
terms,
them all there.
No, in the real terms of stock terms, like your B&Qs, and you put two in a bag, nobody knows it, but it works. I realise that, and I knew that all the time.
And you know what? I would come all the way out here... To spend my money here rather than at
B&Q. But you say that, you see, I know that. If I said to you, though, would you agree if you come here for a knob screw, or I put a grub screw, which I do in door knobs, and I repair it, and it's no big deal. If I said to you, though, the checks and the poles are like we were in the 60s. They haven't got no money, and do you know what? Right, it's a pleasure to serve them. The poles and the checks, seriously, if you go over there, they are actually like we were in the 60s.
Yeah.
But... there's no doubt about it. I've never advertised, never needed to. A lot of stock tied up all my life. It does work, but I'm not saying it's a formula for anybody, young couple starting a shop. Okay.
How can people find you?
Hereford's not big. It's rural. I would have said, if I've been in retail trade 47 years, word of mouth, I never advertise, never needed to advertise, but... this takes all my time. I don't get a life outside.
I would suggest people just go follow the sat nav or whatever you have these days, or your roadmap, your old Phillips roadmap, your AA roadmap to Hereford. Find the town hall, cross the road, and there you are.
Yeah, that's right. I could still sell them a sign if they wanted. Yeah.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Hello to your audience, and thank you for inviting me, Tony. My name is Alexander Azadgan. I am an American professor of strategic global management and international political economy. I'm also a senior geopolitical analyst with Radio Sputnik in Russia, both the English-speaking desk as well as the Persian-speaking desk. I'm an American of Iranian heritage. I'm also a senior geopolitical analyst with Russia's Tsargrad TV, Iran's Press TV, as well as many other independent and alternative media outlets. I'm also a senior fellow with several cutting-edge Iranian think tanks, as well as two think tanks in Russia called Geopolitica and Katerhan.
Can you tell us about Kurdistan then?
Sure. That's being an American of Iranian heritage, Kurdistan is a very sensitive issue to all Iranians. The view that the Iran has toward the Kurds in general is that the Iranians believe the Kurds are actually the most Iranian of all the clans. And by Iranian, I'm talking about the ancient identity of Aryan. Whereas in other countries such as Iraq, Turkey, and even Syria, they're very much looked upon as foreigners or people with heritage from places long away.
Okay, so you're talking about Aryans. Now, this is what Hitler was talking about, the Aryan master race. I don't imagine you're talking about Aryans as a master race, but, I think this will be news for a lot of people that there may be Aryans in Iran or in Kurdistan.
The word Iran literally means land of the Aryans. It's a different phonetic pronunciation of what we consider very sacred. The Iranian and also Indian version of Aryanism is very different than the perverted version of the Third Reich, who misidentified Nordic people as Aryans. There's nothing truthful about that. Aryans, light, which the Nazis misinterpreted as physical light, lightness of skin, again, was a fallacy. When we talk about the Aryan light, we are talking about the light within, which refers to clairvoyance, hypersensitivity, and all sorts of esoteric abilities that these people have. And there's another story or another interpretation of this is that the Aryans itself is another phonetic pronunciation of Atlantean. So this goes back to prehistory for those who believe in Atlantis, and Plato, of course, talked about Atlantis heavily.
Is there any evidence for Atlantis? I mean, some people say it was like the island of the Azores or something like that.
The evidence is extremely circumstantial. It's obviously not empirical, otherwise it would be in our textbooks. Plato talked about it heavily. It wasn't just a place. We believe it was an entire continent. It wasn't just some island with circular buildings or structures around it.
We could look back on it now and say, well, maybe the Phoenicians or someone had already discovered the American continent.
Absolutely. There are many, 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 many interpretations of that. And, of course, it wasn't the Italians. I know the Italian-American community likes to take pride that Amerigo de Vespucci or even Columbus discovered this area. It wasn't. Even if you go to very near history, it was actually the Vikings who got here from Greenland, from Iceland, Denmark, Norway, and then Greenland, and they came down to Nova Scotia and that area. But that's besides the fact. Nevertheless, it is a very huge discussion and part of this Aryan identity. Like I said, Iran, for the past 2,600 years, not only makes sure that the Kurds were their identity, their separate identity as an Aryan tribe was respected. If you go to Persepolis, the ruins of Persepolis in South Iran, where Cyrus, Darius, Xerxes, and all these great kings build incredible structures, in their stone graving, they always distinguish between the Persians in their dress form and what they call Medians, who are the ancient ancestors of what we call the Kurds today. And that came into existence calling it the Medo-Persian Empire that Cyrus created. The Medes, the areas that they call Kurdistan, was a huge continent that the Medes controlled. However, when they came into union with Cyrus around 2,500 years ago, Cyrus the Great, they formed this incredible alliance. It was called the Medo-Persian Empire in the beginning. And then as time went by, the word Mede was dropped and we just had the Persian Empire.
Okay, what about
the most respect for Kurds that unfortunately we don't find in Turkey, Iraq, and to some extent Syria.
Okay, let's go a little bit in the middle, because we were talking about ancient history there. What about the Ottoman Empire? How did they treat the Kurds?
The Ottoman, okay, that's an excellent, excellent question. The Armenians, who were part of the Ottoman Empire and were heavily persecuted, numbers are between 1 million and 1.5 million, have this deep belief that the Kurds are a cursed people, because we have historical evidence that, unfortunately, our Kurdish friends in the Ottoman Empire did the ugly work, did the operational work of the genocide that was imposed on the Kurdish people of Turkey and northern Iraq at that time by the Turkish folks. So that goes back to, I mean, that belief structure is very much there. Whereas Armenia carved their own country out of that area that was predominantly part of the empire, part of the Ottoman Empire, and even the Qajar dynasty of Iran's Persian Empire. So the reason the relations are so terrible in Turkey with their Kurds is that the biggest number of Kurds in the world are actually located in eastern and southeastern Turkey. Something around 14.5 million people, according to the CIA fact book. The numbers could be as high as 16 million. Iran, you have a number around 6 million. This is what the CIA fact book tells us. The number could be as high as 7.6 million. In Iraq, the estimate is between 5 to 6 million Kurds. The number could be as high as 6.5 million. And in Syria, the fourth country, you have to keep in mind there are four countries that have the Kurdish population in the region. In Syria, they have something around 2 million. Outside of Syria, Germany has the highest number of Kurds in diaspora, with the number being 1.5 million in Germany, and the second and the third countries in Europe that have the highest number of Kurds outside of the Middle East are France and Sweden.
Now, hang on, because at some point, I'm not sure if it was under the Ottoman Empire or afterwards, this people have been fractured, haven't they? I mean, split into different countries. The idea, it seems pretty clear to me, for centuries, is that the Kurds deserve their own country.
Well, that is very much the neoliberal perspective.
But it's not. It's not just the neoliberal perspective. It's also the Kurdish perspective. And if people have a shared culture, one does wonder whether it's a good idea to let them have their own nation and some kind of, you know, capitals, their own television, their own museums, their own schools, their own universities, in order to safeguard that culture. I mean, if they're split up into lots of different countries, it seems to me this is a tactic that the British Empire used again and again. The attempt is to actually destroy and fracture that culture.
That is, some of your points are definitely valid. First of all, there's no one Kurdistan. You have the Iraqi Kurds, and even among the Iraqi Kurds, there's massive amounts of division, not because the servants of the empire or the empire itself tried to create that division. You have the gang of Masoud Barzani, who's been in power for the past 150, 200 years. They're a mafia gang. They're highly disrespected. But other Kurds, even just,
okay,
Iraq,
I'm going to interrupt you there, because this is what happens when a people have their nation is fractured, is that you end up with kind of gangsters running the show.
That's right.
This is as a result of that. But why is it that Iranians like yourself and others around the world think that the Kurds don't deserve their own homeland?
It's not that the Kurds don't deserve their homeland. The amount of freedom and expression and their own language, as you said, museums. I just came back from a 3-month academic mission in Iran, and I was in the Iranian Kurdistan significantly, lecturing at universities, and I talked to people. I canvassed. I have first-hand experience in this area, not just once or twice, but on 3 academic missions, which were 3 months in nature during the past 2 years alone. The situation with the Kurds in Iran is quite different. First of all, you have to keep in mind that foreign powers, in the case of Kurds in Iran, in 1946, as the new Shah, the new king, the one that was deposed in 1979, right as he came to power in 1946, you have to keep in mind his father was deposed in 1941 by the British because he had sympathies toward the German and Austrians. At that time, the Germans and Austrians did a lot of good in Iran because they built the modern infrastructure. He was deposed literally 5 years later. Soviet Union took advantage of this chaotic situation in the transfer of power in the Iranian monarchy and wanted to create a communist republic of Kurdistan. So this, the foreign meddling in internal affairs of other countries, even when it comes to Soviet Union, who now, as Russia, is Iran's greatest ally. And then in 1979, we had this second situation. Again, they took advantage of the chaos and anarchy and wanted to start a, a republic called Mahabad Republic. They were heavily suppressed. The territorial integrity of Iran will not be questioned. Iran, we will not allow Iran to become Yugoslavia. In the entire Middle East, there is a strong movement against the Balkanization of the Middle East. And of course, ISIS was step one in this whole process. ISIS is being defeated, although the CIA and Mossad and MI6, they're going to talk them away. So phase two is Kurdistan. In other words, as you correctly pointed out, divide and conquer.
Well, the Sykes-Picot agreement, which was leaked by the Russians, wasn't it? By the Soviet Union, by the senior people. I mean, we may not even have known about it today if it wasn't for them leaking it. The Sykes-Picot agreement divided up the Middle East into areas which went right across ethnic boundaries in a deliberate attempt to divide and rule. And to create problems for the future that could then be exploited, you know, so that the area could be destabilised. And surely there is actually almost a natural settling out of that, if we're going to have a peaceful future, into various new countries of ethnic groups. Now, I know that United States Colonel Ralph Peters, put out a map, didn't he, which is the Americans' projected version of what the Middle East should be look like, a Balkanized version. Is it not possible for the people of the Middle East, for the Kurds, for the Iranians, for the Syrians, to sit down and say, well, we don't agree with the Pentagon's version. We agree that things need to change, but they should look like this.
Things need to change in Turkey drastically. You mentioned change. I'll answer the last question first to go back to your other points. In Turkey, you can't even speak Kurdish in Kurdish schools. This is, they're using very severe Ottoman methods from 100 or 150 years ago. And of course, what you're going to end up with? People wanting to rebel. People say, forget about you. You're going to be a separate country and what have you. It's, the situation is quite different in Iran. And you mentioned about the map of Middle East being completely artificial. You're absolutely correct when it comes to Arab countries. Every Arab country, even their flags, were designed by one or two-star British general, except for two countries whose land, whose territorial map today is completely natural and the British had nothing to do with it. One is Turkey, and then second one is Iran. The big chunk of Iran, all the way up to Georgia, Chechnya, all these lands were unfortunately, because of the incompetence of the Iranian Qajar dynasty, were given away to Russia. For certain reasons, because that dynasty was very weak. But everybody else's map, Kuwait, UAE, Saudi Arabia, all of them, Yemen, were practically drawn by people that were not even high-ranking generals. And you see, and that's all coming apart. That's all coming apart, Tony. And then on the other hand, you have Princeton professors, people like Bernard Lewis, who had their own map of the Middle East, and it's readily available online. Whether it's true or whether it's propaganda, we are, as academics, we're still researching that. But he was a very famous Islamologist, Islamic expert at Princeton, I believe with a British background and a Jewish ethnicity, and they have a grand plan in changing the whole thing. ISIS was about that. This Kurdistan movement is about that. The secession of Kurdistan means the continuation of this ridiculous war, which probably goes back to 1990.
But surely, the secession of the Kurdish people is likely to lead to less war. I mean, that's the whole point, isn't it? That if they're given, say, for example, some territory to the south of Turkey and some territory within Turkey itself, then there's less likely to be tension. I mean, it might even mean that some of the ethnically Kurdish people can move into that new territory and stop the conflict.
Except that it's not just the Kurds who live in that territory. There is integration in all those so-called Kurdish areas in those four countries. I believe that assessment is, unfortunately, I hate to say, is a bit naive. Those of us who are from the region, those of us who speak the languages, not just one language,
but the Kurdish people have just voted for this, haven't they, in Iraq.
Yes, of course, the referendum was there. They voted. It was totally symbolic. If you know the near history of Barzani clan's behavior, they did the same thing when ISIS came into power because they realized the Iraqi central parliament and the army was quite demoralized and that they could. Now, because the Iraqi army, thanks to the assistance of regional powers like Iran, is quite invigorated. They have their morale back. And this referendum was to stop this new, you know, invigoration, if you may call that, of the Iraqis going up north and settling this. That's one element of it. It's not just a question of settling people. You have energy. Energy is a huge factor in this. And by that, I mean petroleum and even natural gas. There's major disputes over the city of Kirkuk. There are major disputes over the city of Erbil, because these are huge income-generating cities traditionally and now for the nation of Iraq.
Okay,
that
Alexander.
Away, you're basically neuterizing Iraq. So,
Alexander, I'm going to put the $64,000 question to you. Yes. If you were, I don't know who it would even be in the modern world, an American general, shall we say, a British prime minister, how do we sort this situation out in the Middle East? Because we cannot allow this situation of various ethnic groups around that part of the world being separated. Yeah. And also, of course, we've got a very powerful US-backed state, Israel, which is looking to expand. So what would you now do if you were in charge?
The project for greater Israel is to some extent true, but it's a myth. That the Israelis couldn't even manage 10 kilometers of Lebanon when they invaded in 1982. So if that project is going to get implemented, it's purely economic, as is the case with the Iraqi Kurdistan. The biggest investor in Iraqi Kurdistan are Israeli super capitalists and then other Jewish capitalists from America and Europe, number one. Number two, I'm sorry to say this, but the British, and I'm an American as well, so I'm saying this toward my own people. Americans and British have no, this is not your region. You need to get out. You're never welcome there. You took it over after the Ottoman Empire fell, the incompetent Ottoman Empire. And frankly speaking, it's not up to the British or the American to sort, as you brilliantly put it out, to sort things out behind ethnicities. The last time NATO tried to do that, we saw this horrible mess in Yugoslavia. In order to neuter Serbia, because Serbia is the ideological center in Eastern Europe when it comes to Russian and Slavic alliance. So it's quite arrogant for us to think that America or Britain or any other power to be.
But I think what we need from you is a bit of vision for the future. What would be the best way for things to proceed in the Middle East?
Get out. The vision is get out. You were never welcome there. You are not going to be welcome there. In Middle East, they're still talking about things that happened 200 years ago. They don't seem to have this amnesia that we have in America. Get out of there. Let them sort it out. Let them duke it out. Now, the only reason we don't get out of there is because of energy, geopolitical complications. And also, we have nations like Saudi-controlled Arabia and
so
recently,
are you
Qatar,
saying that Middle Eastern nations should just fight it? Are you saying Middle Eastern nations? Are you saying Middle Eastern nations should fight it out amongst themselves?
Middle Eastern nations should duke it out. I didn't use the word fight. They should duke it out diplomatically and in every other way. The only reason I would want to be in Middle East is because I don't want to pay $10 a gallon for gas. Okay, that's the truth. Let me just. I am an academic. We speak very frankly. I do not want to pay $10 a gallon, as our measurement system is here, your old British system, in America. That's it. But that's changing, Tony.
Okay, Alexander. But just to
the greatest producer of oil and natural gas in the years to come. So we don't need these people.
Anyway,
let them fight it out.
Good to hear.
And let them come to some consensus. As the Iranians, I have to say this, and I'm not saying this because I have a bias. God knows I...
It's good to hear that you don't think that the Israelis are trying... It's good to hear you don't think that the Israelis are trying to expand. That is good to hear, because I think there's a lot of people in this part of the world that
have their wicked hand in anything in the Middle East. And this runs counter to Israeli interests. There's huge dissent within Israel, liberal and conservative faction. What is happening in Israel with the re-election of this little antichrist monster called Netanyahu is, if you know anything about psychology, is in time of great distress. We tend to take refuge in that ugly, over-testosterone male image. During times like that, we especially need to take refuge under what we call the sacred feminine. Because the sacred feminine is about a vision, as you pointedly call it. It's about solutions. It's about peacekeeping. But what do we do in all cultures? We gravitate toward dictators like Trump, dictator in training.
Well, I think I can tell you here in Britain, many people are just repelled by people like Netanyahu and Trump. But anyway, look, how can people follow your work?
So much more evolved in Britain than we are in the United States.
How can people follow your work, Alexander?
People can follow my work by simply Googling me and YouTubing me.
Well, we don't advertise Google on here, but anyway, sure. You can have a search for you. Whereabouts, you know, are you most regularly easy to find, and have you got any books out that we can mention?
I have written 6 books. Unfortunately, because of the nature of my books and my personal security, I can never take credit for your books because they were written anonymously. My other work, articles or what have you, is published on Geopolitica, not with an L at the end, geopolitica.ir.ru, which is in Russia, the think tank that I work in Russia. This is part of Alexander Dugin's group. I work with them. I don't work for them, but I work with them because I believe in this Eurasian vision. This is going to put NATO in its place, and it's going to create a multilateral or bipolar world again. We need this desperately. And then we have around 500 videos on my YouTube channel, Truth. It's called Truth, Justice, Peace. Peace, that's the abbreviation for it. But if you simply go to YouTube and type my name, Alexander Azadgan, Alpha, Zulu, Alpha, Delta, Alpha, Nike, then my videos, my lectures will come up in several languages, my TV interviews, what have you. We present a totally different vision than the lies that the fake news media at the helm, CNN.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the BBC as well. I think when you're talking about a multipolar world and you're talking about reigning back NATO, there's the vast majority of population in Britain would agree with you because they've led us into these various hideous wars. And it's almost as if after the end of the Cold War, really, they should have been abolished. And they realized that. And so they decided to find out a new mission for themselves to create wars all over the place and mayhem. And they need to be, it's almost like the stake needs to be driven into their heart somehow. And so yes. I think we're on the same page on that one, Alexander.
Absolutely. I think we're on the same page on many other issues. It's just we haven't known each other. NATO needs to go. NATO's purpose was this concept of perpetual war that you guys had in Europe for centuries. What NATO is doing in the Middle East is trying to trigger a 100-year war. Just the kind of war you had, like the War of the Roses between the British and the French, or this Catholic Protestant war that still is, to some extent, is resonating in Northern Ireland. This is the plan they have for Middle East. This is the amount of wickedness that they're planning in that region. Why? The average age in Middle East, 80% of the population from Morocco all the way to Pakistan is under the age of 40. Tremendous human resource potential, tremendous natural resource potential, tremendous, I'm not a fan of EU, Tony, but tremendous amount of potential in coming up with some kind of a confederation so the foreigners would be held out. The U.S. doesn't want that. Even NATO and Europeans don't want that. They want savages, they want stooges, they want vassal states like Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, UAE, up to recently Qatar. They want these things to happen. They don't have any long-term vision. These lackeys, these traitors, these warmongers at the Pentagon.
Okay, so it's look, exactly what you said. Finally,
divide and conquer. Let it go for 500 years. When there's war and anarchy in that area, we'll get their oil at $40 a gallon.
Finally, give us your crystal ball. Where are we going to be in 10, 15 years' time?
Things are going to get much worse before they get better. My forecast that there might be even a mini nuclear confrontation. This confrontation, however, will be contained rather quickly for many reasons. We are much more evolved than we used to be. Even the testing of nuclear weapons, for example, in the Pacific by the North Koreans, is getting a huge backlash from the environmental groups. So we have evolved since 1946, since my country shamelessly dropped those bombs on the Japanese, knowing that they were going to surrender. So it's going to get much worse. Here in the United States, I mean, we have case studies. We have in Puerto Rico when we are having this hurricane, the electricity is out. My contacts in Pentagon tell me that if our electrical grid in the United States, which is rather outdated, is out for 6 months, 90% of the American population is going to perish. We're going to have huge depopulation. Some of this is going to be contrived by those Rothschild scumbags who want to keep the Earth's population to 500 million, and they've openly declared it. We'll have a situation where there will be conflict between China and the United States, as China is flexing its muscles, that is getting stronger and more viable. It's going to be more hegemonic, as they are already practicing to some extent with some of these small islands, which are sitting on huge amounts of natural gas under the so-called South China Sea and that whole area. We're going to see a rejuvenation of Russia. Thank God for that. Russia is bad. Again, this is what I'm about to say is may sound controversial to those of your audience who are secular, but Russia is backing the arms of Mother Church, the Russian, Holy Russian Orthodox Church. They have came out of those 7 years of ugly communist, the secular years, where it was actually the whole thing was a Zionist concoction. I don't use the word Jewish. I use the word Zionist. I don't want to insult our Jewish brothers and sisters. That came to an end. The Russians know it now. They never want to go back to their years. However, the Russians have imperialistic and hegemonic tendencies, but they want to do it differently than what the Anglo-American Empire has been presenting. So we'll have a resurgence of Russia as it's happening. My worry is what keeps me up at night sometimes, Tony, is what's going to happen with the transfer of power when President Putin is no longer with us. Because President Putin himself is an institution, and unfortunately, Russia, we are lacking institutions. The secret to the Anglo-American success during the past 500 years, with UK, and then the past 250 years with America, is these institutions that we have. And this is what has kept the whole thing together. Once people lose their faith in these institutions, as it has been happening in the United States for the past 20 years, the whole house of cards is going to start crumbling. Nevertheless, these institutions will prolong the lifespan of the American empire.
Which institutions are you talking about?
I'm talking about governmental, social, and economic institutions. When it comes to the government, I'm talking about the U.S. Congress, which, by the way, happens to have a popularity of 12% to 14%, according to Gallup. This is changing. This is going to change. We have a popular wave in this country, both from the right and from the left, radical right and radical left. If somehow these two unite, we will be at the threshold of a second American Revolution.
Oh, that's fascinating. Fascinating. All right. Thanks very much, Alexander.
Thank you for your time, and I look forward to the feedback from your audience.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, that's all for this week. Dialects Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast. You can download it to listen on your phone or in the car. And subscribe if you like and listen the week before broadcast at dialectradio1word.co.uk. Thanks to our guests, that's Dilwyn Jones from Hereford, and also to Professor Alexander Azadgan from California. Also to studio engineer Dave Bazanko. Dialects of Bristol Broadband Co-op production catches on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon, and anyone can contribute. Contact us through the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, just off Jamaica Street, on 0117 909 6897. They're online at prsc.org.uk. You can volunteer with us or for hundreds of opportunities elsewhere in Britain if you have the time via the National Volunteering website, do-it.org. That was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Till the same time next week. Goodbye for now.
Wild dogs cry out in the night as they grow restless, longing for some solitary company. I know that I must do what's right, sure as Kilimanjaro rises like Olympus above the Serengeti. I seek to cure what's deep inside, frightened